1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Welcome to the show, Higher Side Chatters. I'm Greg Carlwood from sunny San Diego, drinking a little drink, smoking a ton of smoke. Just a quick update on the THC Money Bomb before we get going. As you've heard, I'm giving away half the donations I get by episode 85 to one of you guys, and so far this is turning out great. We're still chugging along. We've added about another $40 in donations this week, which puts another $20 in the listener prize pool. Donations definitely slowed up a little bit this week, but we're at about $300, which means that I'm going to be giving away at least $150, and I feel pretty good about that. And we're not done yet, so keep donating, keep contributing to that prize pool, and somebody's going to be very happy, as well as myself. We're still collecting for the next few weeks, and I'll have a winner on episode 85. So if you want all the details, just go to thehiresidechats.com/donate, and all the info is there, including how to be in the running without making a donation if you're unable to do so. And with that said, I'm going to try to motivate you into buying a shirt from me with this Conspiraties ad, and then we've got your higher education for the week with Rob Davin. And then we're going deep into science with our guest Jim Elvidge. He's going to make the case that we might just be living in a programmed reality. Boom.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the brave roof tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Okay, people, I'm here with Rob Davin, the Higher Side Chats newsman, with this week's higher education, the news that gives you clues as we try to figure out what's going on in this weird world of ours. Rob, my man, what's a good word?
Well, today we got a couple more weird ones. I think that's just going to be our theme here. So to get started, a bizarre and violent series of events at an Oklahoma City apartment involving a Bible burning blood and a homosexual demon and destruction has landed a man behind bars. Officers were called to an Oklahoma City apartment Wednesday for a reported person going ballistic. Officer said that a caller mentioned a man whose face was bloody had kicked in a heavy apartment door off its hinges, poured salt and soap all over himself, and was breaking glass and other objects. An officer said the man was clearly out of touch with reality. The police report states that Anderson said he started the fire in his apartment because he was cooking the Bible because he was a Satanist. Anderson then told the officers he met a possessed homosexual demon who wanted drugs from him and performed sexual acts on him. He said he wasn't gay, just high.
Amen, brother.
I know, right? When he came to his senses, he couldn't believe that he let the male demon touch him. So, yeah, you know, don't get high and play with gay demons, I guess.
Yeah, that's the moral of that story.
Wow,
what else is happening?
Okay, well, in one that's not quite as funny but still disturbing, a Valley woman who posted a video of what she says was yellow water coming from her faucet is now being sued for defamation by the utility company. Johnson Ranch resident Emily Hughes was in the shock for her life when she turned on her tap on a recent morning. "I came downstairs and I went to wash the dishes and there was yellow water," she says. But if Hughes was surprised by what she described as yellow water coming from her faucet, she was even more surprised by what followed after she posted the video online. "This is my lawsuit that I was served," she tells us, holding up a stack of legal papers. "Huh. It is a defamation lawsuit seeking $100,000 in damages, accusing Hughes of making disparaging postings with the intent to disparage and harm Johnson Utilities. This is a private utility that delivers water to Hughes and other customers in the Southeast Valley." Yeah, like, I don't understand this one. How can she be charged for posting what was clearly yellow water coming out of her faucet?
It's just a sign of the times, man. Corporations are like privileged elites, and the government works for them. The legal system works for them. It looks more and more ridiculous when we see things like this happen, but it's not surprising.
No, it you can see it everywhere. I mean, here in Canada, we're having the same problems with corporations are just coming in and totally raping and pillaging everything, and there seems to be no recourse in the legal system.
Yeah. Very inspiring times we live in.
No doubt. So let's get on to the last story of the week. Okay. And it's probably the most disappointing news this week. I was crushed. I broke down and started crying. An icon associated with paranoia, the tinfoil hat, is believed to protect the wearer from invasive radio waves by creating a Faraday cage around the skull, preventing aliens, reptilians, and the Anunnaki from being able to read your thoughts. Mm-hmm. However, The Atlantic noted in the existence of a 2005 Massachusetts Institute of Technology study on the effectiveness of tinfoil hats as a Faraday cage. As a matter of fact, the aluminum helmets actually amplify radio waves in the frequency range currently used by the government for cell phone companies and satellites. The study concluded that the FCC and the government must have propagated the myth of the tinfoil hat in order to make it easier to read thought patterns of those who would wear them. Could tinfoil hats be themselves part of the grand conspiracy? Who knows?
Oh, man. That's like a low-tech version of identifying people by going to Alex Jones forums or something.
Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't started selling tinfoil hats.
Yeah, that's crushing. Man, you know, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about, you know, a big thing that happened this week is that LAX shooter. And I know we've both seen the photos of the dummy in the wheelchair and the scene at the scene of the shooting, which is suggesting to a lot of people that this is another staged attack, but you've been sort of critical on that viewpoint. I mean, do you think this is just what it appears this time, a random lone gunman?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've looked into all the latest mass shootings with Aurora and Sandy Hook and the other ones. And those ones, there's a lot of strange occurrences around it. You know, a lot of things that make you stop and go, that's different. But with this LAX one, it's pretty cut and simple. I mean, the guy walked in with a gun. People saw it. He shot only shot one person and wounded two others. Killed one person and wounded two others. But what the alternative media is using as the conspiracy is the photo of him laying on the ground, and there's a pool of what looks to be red gelatin laying beside him.
Congealed blood, yeah.
Exactly. And he's got his arms kind of behind his back, and he's laying in a weird position. And as I pointed out, anybody that's ever hunted would know that if you shoot an animal in the upper body close to the lungs, that congealed blood goop stuff that you see on the ground, that's typical of any hunt. And then the way he's laying, they're saying, oh, well, it's a dummy. He's laying on the ground. Look at the way he's laying. But if you notice, his hands are behind his back and he's probably handcuffed, and that would explain the contorted look of him. Plus, he was probably had the shit kicked out of him by the cops, because that's of typical of them, right? They get the cuffs on him and then they beat the living hell out of him for, you know, shooting one of theirs.
Yeah, standard protocol.
Exactly, and I just don't see anything strange with this one. I mean, it all seems pretty cut and dry, and unless any other evidence comes out to make me think otherwise, I'm just going to call this one a lone gunman that was crazy.
And that's fair. I mean, I know the pictures you're talking about of him, that looks totally legit to me. I don't know what's going on with the aerial shot with the dummy in the wheelchair. That's a little bit odd, but it's also like so obvious. I can't imagine that would be used. Like, you know, that would be used as something legitimate.
Exactly. It could be something as simple as they were using that dummy as a staging prop for something else at the time of the shooting, and they were just getting it out of the area. Like, there's nothing really there to make me think that there's any sort of conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, one big thing, though, is it's just so convenient that it provides a catalyst to have armed TSA guards or at least military personnel at the airport. Because if you just do a Google search on this story, every major outlet is asking about armed guards, armed TSA now. It's the new conversation. So I got to admit, that's a bit of a gift for the global elite.
Oh, it is. It is. And I think sometimes they just use this stuff as their cover to push the stuff through. But other times they create the events. I don't know. I do find it funny that the apparent shooter has shown absolutely no signs of being crazy. That's kind of fishy. But beyond that, I haven't really seen anything that makes me think that the government did it. I'm sure they will use it, as they usually do for any event that they can, you know, manipulate.
Yeah, the only other thing that makes me skeptical is I'm starting to wonder if, you know, when stories come out that are so well synchronized across all the competing, in air quotes, networks, it seems like there are stories like, for example, Sandy Hook and Aurora, those things are like on there and they're on there all the at the same time as if it was handed down. But then there are events that happen. There are, like, there was a guy who went into a mall and shot like 7 people. There was another school shooting a few months back, ones that don't make the news. And I wonder if that's because those are the real events that weren't expected to happen. And the ones that do just hit like wildfire are planned events. And that's not based on anything. That's just something I've been thinking about in the past year.
It is weird. A good way to look at it, because that is true. You know, before the Aurora shooting, the day before, somebody walked into a mall and started firing off rounds, and I believe 3 or 4 people were killed.
Yeah,
and it never made the news, but Aurora happens like the next day or the next week, and suddenly that's everywhere.
And here's the story of one man getting shot. You know, I mean, I'm from St. Louis. There were 4 people killed in a day, and that's like amongst friends of mine a big thing because it's where they live. It seems like a safe area, but that wasn't national news.
Exactly. I mean, there's been incidents here in Canada where people have been, they found a car full of like 6 bikers and it shot to death. That wasn't major news,
right? So I wonder sometimes with the synchronization and the overblown production to some of these particular stories, maybe they are that quick. Maybe they just find a real random event that serves the cause and amplify it. But, I mean, I've also seen several stories recently about Obama firing a lot of high-ranking military officials. And I guess the idea is behind that is that the administration is removing generals and officers that seem resistant to the idea of firing on American people. And it's a lot of speculation, but I wonder if this isn't close to the path we're walking on.
Well, it does seem to be the road we're headed down. I mean, that's what they want. They want TSA on the streets of America. They want the same thing here in Canada. It's just they're slowly working towards it. So every little event that happens like this, whether they plan it or not, they're going to use it to the best that they possibly can.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I feel a little bit smarter. Thanks for doing this. You know, people, check out everything Rob's doing. Ton of conspiracy goodness at darkspace.tv. And we'll see you next week, man. Thanks again.
All right, buddy.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Welcome to the party. Tonight, we're going to grab the red solo cup of consciousness, walk it to the keg of infinite possibility, garnish it with a little high weirdness, and throw that baby back, because we're getting drunk on science and speculation tonight. Simulation theory, the nature of consciousness, the technological singularity, and a bunch of other stuff I'm going to pretend to understand. And our guest for this wild ride is Jim Elvidge, who holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University, and for many years has kept pace with the latest research, theories, and discoveries in the varied fields of subatomic physics, cosmology, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and the paranormal. This unique knowledge has provided a perfect foundation for his book, The Universe Solved, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have him here. Jim, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much for having me, Greg. Looking forward to the show.
Of course, man. It's a real pleasure. You know, I've been really looking forward to this one. There's so many things to talk about, but let's start with this programmed reality theory of yours. I mean, it's pretty far out there. The idea that we're living in a simulation or a computer program, something like The Matrix. I've liked that idea for a while when the movie came out, but I've never really entertained it much as a real possibility until reading some of your thoughts and Nick Bostrom's thoughts, and now I don't know what to think. So can you tell the people a little bit about this program reality idea?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And people are probably most familiar with it through some of the movies from Hollywood, maybe some science fiction writing, Philip K. Dick, and other people who have explored these kinds of ideas over the years. And that's cool, because they generally give some sort of description of it, or, you know, a reason for it to be. Mm-hmm. In The Matrix, for example, there was a sinister aspect to what was behind The Matrix.
Yes.
Other people may say that it isn't, you know, that way, that it could be just a simulation that that we've put together in the future and we're just running. I think that's more Bostrom's idea. But it actually, I mean, it goes back pretty far. Conrad Zuse, I think, was the first person to postulate the idea, and that was in 69, I believe, that our world could be digital. And from there, you can go in a bunch of different directions. You can say, well, it could be digital, but there could be nothing behind it. Or you could say, well, it could be digital, but there's some programmatic aspect to it, and therefore there was a programmer. Or it could be that it's not an entity per se that we think of an entity, but it was more of a system that evolved and generated this reality, but, you know, in a digital form. So, you know, all these things kind of fit into the general field of digital philosophy or digital physics, if you will, and you know, we can explore the pros and cons of a lot of the different ideas.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I thought was most interesting that I'd heard you say in the past is it's very likely that at some point we'll be able to simulate reality. So isn't it also likely that we've already been there, that we're already there now?
Yeah, exactly. And that's Nick Bostrom's sort of philosophical, you know, logical argument, and it's really hard to find fault with it. He's saying that given where we think we are, you know, we're pursuing these kinds of simulations now. We do it with, you know, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, and we do it with, you know, virtual reality, and it gets more and more accurate all the time. And that, you know, we follow Moore's Law with the, you know, escalating speed of computers and the escalating resolution of our screens and things like that. At some point, we won't be able to tell the difference between reality and a simulation. We're there now in terms of what we can hear. You know, we could put some unobtrusive headphones on and not be able to tell the difference between a surf or really being down, you know, at the beach and listening to the waves. And from a visual perspective, if you're able to cover your full field of vision, you know, we can generate that kind of resolution that is equivalent to the visual acuity of the eye today. So we're really close. And,
right,
you know, the only thing that kind of remains to be done is a scenario or a, you know, the richness of a reality, and something about our memories. Because if we were to play a simulation, put on a headset, and, you know, execute a simulation, we know, because we've got the memories that we existed before we started the simulation, and mm-hmm. and that this is just a simulation. So that brings into question about, you know, the idea of how accurate are the memories? How much can we believe in the memories that we think we have? And, you know, honestly, there's a tremendous amount of research in brain-computer interface that's going on where memories are being erased in mice. You know, they will teach a mouse how to do something, erase the memory, re-inject the memory, you know, and show that they can actually inject false memories into mice and rats in the laboratory. So, if they're doing that now, and again, we follow the progression, the logical progression of science and technology, there is going to be some day where we can suspend our memory, inject a new kind of set of memory artifacts, if you will, run a simulation, and then restore our old memory again. So Bostrom says he refers to that as the concept of post-humanism. So when you get to a point where you can generate your own sort of fantasy reality, if you will. And, that may be 20 or 30 years away. So his argument goes like this. If that's possible, and we know that it's possible, there's only one of three things that can happen. Either we never get there, but because in the next 30 years we blow ourselves up as a society, or we never get there because we make a conscious decision not to get there. And that one, I tend to disregard that one, because I think, when have we ever stared an interesting technology in the face and said, not gonna pursue that.
Agreed. Right? I totally agree.
And then the third one is we do get there, and we generate millions and millions of simulations. And so then if that's the case, then the odds that we're in the one 30 years before that time versus one of the millions that gets generated is very small. So if you think through his logic, if you're a pessimist, you'll believe that we're going to blow ourselves up in the next 30 years. If you're an optimist, you would have to believe that we're actually in a simulation.
When you take that a step further, we could be just stuck in an infinite loop of digital realities within digital realities, where we learn more and more and more and create another one and create another one.
Ian, I think that's actually really an insightful thought, because, it's sort of like a fractal. If you're
exactly.
familiar with the pictures that show these fractal images, and the more you zoom in on them, you see the same thing. And there are a number of scientists and physicists and so forth, Tom Campbell comes to mind, who believe that our reality is a fractal. And if you look at it at different scales, you see the same thing, the same kind of structures, not just physical structures, but the way things tend to work.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole idea of, well, we could be in a simulation now, and in our simulation we're creating simulations, and in that simulation we're creating a virtual reality game, and someday that'll be a simulation. You know what I mean? That
yeah.
that whole aspect of things is also fractal. So it all kind of fits.
Yeah, I mean, on the subject of fractals, I've seen those pictures where people put on one side like a cell in the human body, and on the other side a galaxy, and they look
yeah.
so similar.
Yeah.
It's that same Zen philosophy point of, everything is part of the whole.
Isn't it? Yep.
Yeah.
I really like those, and it's striking when you look at some of these cosmological maps of the known universe and all these little tendrils and things like that are in the maps, and then you take a look at a cell or something, and you see the same structures. And that's not to say that the cell is a universe for some other entities. That could be a little bit of a crazy idea, or maybe not, but the more to the point is that there's some organizing principle to our mm-hmm. reality that makes things group together in large scales the way it makes things group together in small scales, the way things communicate in large scales, that is similar to the way they communicate in small scales, the way they form structures and so forth. And that organizing principle, what is that? We haven't discovered that from a scientific standpoint. Some physicists might point to things like string theory or grand unified field theory or something mm-hmm. like that. But those are really things that are meant to describe physical matter particles, and not really to describe these mega structures of our reality. So just the fact that they repeat at different scales is interesting by itself, and kind of implies that, there's some organizing force at work here.
I mean, other examples of that is the Fibonacci sequence and the phi ratio, that idea that there's just some type of code to it all. And I spend a lot of my time in the conspiracy world, but that kind of ties in, because that is apparently the type of knowledge that secret societies have held on to for generations and generations and generations. And the ultimate could be that they're like, oh, yeah, well, this is the program that we've created, and, you know, we're living on top of it here, and we could exit at any point, but they don't have the ability to do that. You know, wouldn't that be a trip?
Well, it is really interesting. I agree with you. If you go back and look at some of the, you know, the ancient texts, the Sumerian texts, or some of the you know, hieroglyphs that you see at various ancient sites and things, and you know, try to figure out what they're telling us, we tend in the past we've had this sort of arrogant assumption that, oh well, they were just inferior to where we are now, so they couldn't have been on to anything significant, you mm-hmm. know. But it only seems to happen that the more we learn about our past, the more surprised we are at how rich it was and how you know, philosophically accurate it was, or something like that. And it's the same way with the way we treat animals. The more we investigate how animals communicate and how they behave, the more surprised we are that, oh my gosh, they have you know, ecosystems and social systems just like we do. Why is it that we don't assume that in the first place? You know, why do we have to assume that humans in the past and other species of animals are necessarily inferior to us? And why do we have to assume that we humans have the access to all that there is, or all that there could be to know? I think it's a very you know, arrogant point of view.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, the universe is a weird place. We seem to figure out more about it all the time. One point that you've discussed in the past that I thought was really interesting is the scientific trend, this pattern that seems to occur where every new leap in understanding yields a larger ratio between matter and empty space. You know, we kind of discover that the universe is more empty than it is full. Walk us through that trend a little bit, and where do you see that trend going or ending, if it ever ends?
Oh, sure. That one's really fascinating to me, and it's actually a pattern that I just kind of noticed just a few months ago, and I wrote a blog on it. You know, we know that over the years we've been, you know, peering deeper and deeper into the atom as we get more and more powerful instruments like the Linear Hadron Collider and things like that, higher energy instruments that we can use to break apart things and look deeper in. Mm-hmm. So, but if you look at the kind of history, you actually see a pattern. You see a trend here, which was a revelation to me. So let's go back to the ancient Greeks. They thought that everything was made of these little hard billiard ball type objects, call them atoms. And let's take gold, for example, that gold was, you know, gold bar consisted of a bunch of those little billiard ball type indivisible things called atoms that were just packed together. Well, if you pack together kind of spherical things, there's going to be some empty space in between them as well. And the empty space is something like 28% of the total space it takes up. So this, we didn't really advance from this theory until, you know, well into the 1800s. John Dalton revised the theory in that time, and then there were some, you know, changes to the theory of atoms. But the real breakthrough came in the early 1900s with Ernest Rutherford's experiment that showed that there was a nucleus to the atom, and they were able to determine what the cross-section of that nucleus was, roughly how big that thing was. And found out that, wow, you know, not only is not our gold bar isn't really just like 80% stuff, and that's the word that I tend to use. Mm-hmm. It's more like 1 × 10⁻¹⁵ stuff. So one part in, you know, I guess that would be maybe 1,000 trillion. Jeez. Stuff. So it's so much empty space that it's almost inconceivable. But it didn't end there. In the 60s, with quark theory, they realized that, you know, the nucleus, these protons and neutrons, were actually composed of something else. They're composed of quarks, and those quarks were much, much smaller, and that most of a proton was empty space. So now the you know, and they've been able to do some estimates on cross sections of quarks. Now they're saying that, you know, one, our gold bar is a, one part in 10 to the 28th, you know, stuff, and everything else is empty space. And then the string theorists came around in the 80s and 90s and said, well, you know, even quarks are made of something else. They're made of these little vibrating bits of string that, you know, vibrate at different frequencies for different particles. And the width of this string is what's known as the Planck length. And the Planck length is something like 10 to the minus 35 meters. It's the limit of quantum mechanics. It's the limit beyond which you can't probe any deeper. And that's what they say the width of the string is. So if you do that calculation, you're up to something like one part in 10 to the 52. And 1 part in 10 to the 30th is equivalent to a grain of sand is to the size of the Earth. So 1 part in 10 to the 52 is like a grain of sand, you know, in the solar system or maybe the galaxy or something. I'm not even sure. I haven't done that calculation, but it's ridiculously empty. And, you know, I start thinking, well, what's the point of having stuff anyway? The trend is that every 60 years or so, we lose about 15 orders of magnitude of density of our stuff in the best theories of science. So if we keep going in that direction, we're heading toward the ultimate, which is there really is no stuff. It's really just data, which to me is kind of one of these big trends that I see happening in scientific theory, and as we kind of peel the onion of what makes all of this tick, of what the rules are in science, we peel it back further and further, we find that there's less and less stuff, and probably at the end of the day, there's none. All it is data and rules. And if you think about it, if the string theorists are right, they say that a particle is only defined by one number, and that number is the frequency that string is vibrating at. Well, if you can define a particle by one number, what do you need the string for anyway? You just have the number.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So you know, and people will argue, well, I feel stuff. You know, I put my hand on the table and I feel this the hardness of it. And well, actually, you don't. What you're experiencing is the
charge,
you know, electromagnetic
right?
charge. Yeah, electromagnetic field charge of the atoms in your fingertips repelling against the electromagnetic field charge in the atoms of the table. And what you're seeing is reflected light, you know, off of that. And when you really think about this very deeply, it's okay to say that everything is data and everything is data and rules. And so when I punch a wall, the rule is that, you know, I'm going to get a sensation that is a result of the, you know, very deep rules of electromagnetic interaction and how they translate to pressure and things like that that get converted into bits in my nervous system and get processed by my mind. So when you really think through this stuff, there's no evidence for any stuff at all, and there's really a lot of evidence that we're heading toward a trend of recognizing that everything is just made of data and rules. So that's more evidence for a digital world or a programmed world.
Yeah, man, it's really hard to wrap my head around it. And another component to this is the idea of the conscious observer. I mean, there's been some experiments that seem to suggest that waves stay waves until they have a conscious observer, and then they become particles, or they make some type of choice. Again, it's pretty over my head, but there are those studies out there. What do you make of that? What role do you think human consciousness plays?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, really the way is a great question. I think that is kind of the key fundamental aspect of what is under investigation today in any field of science. It's the key thing that is showing that our reality isn't what we think it is. Everything else that we're studying is just kind of peeling back the onion. But this observer effect that you're talking about, and some of the aspects of quantum mechanics, entanglement, and things like that, are showing that deep, deep down, our reality is very, very different from the mechanistic type of approach that, you know, most scientists have believed over the years. And in this experiment you're talking about, this double slit experiment, has been, you know, replicated countless times. And the way that it works is that every time human consciousness gets involved in observing the result of the experiment sort of locks into a particular result. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the way this experiment works is you have a little detector on the backside of effectively like a cardboard that has slits in it, and you're shooting particles through that, and the detector detects whether, you know, whether the particle went through one slit or another. And if you have that detector there and you're looking at the results of the detector so that you, as a human, know where each particle is going through, then you no longer get that waveform. But if you turn the detector off, or if you let the detector on but somehow are not paying attention to the detector, or, you know, having a, you know, a conscious observation, there will be a waveform on the screen. So they've tried to tease out all the possible explanations of this weird effect. Like, they used to think, well, maybe it has to do with the fact that the detector is stealing away a little bit of energy from these particles or something, and that was disproven not too long ago in Tel Aviv, a scientific lab there. And finally, in I think it was 2008, these physicists in Vienna determined to a ridiculous level of certainty, 80 orders of certainty, meaning the odds of this being chance were 1 in, you know, 10 to the 80th kind of thing, that reality doesn't exist at all until we observe it. So what do I make of that? You know, I think about it from the programmatic standpoint. If I were creating a reality that is programmatic, I would do it exactly this way, and here's why. Let's say you want to create a coffee cup or something. Mm-hmm. Let's use a tree because it's bigger. That's the one that I typically use. So do you really have to define what's inside the tree? You don't. And from a programmatic standpoint, it would take an awful lot of memory resources and computational resources to calculate the structure of things that nobody's ever going to look at. So mm-hmm. you don't bother doing that. If I were creating this kind of, you know, simulation program, all I would create is what people can experience. So now as soon as somebody cuts into the tree, there has to be something that generates the construct of the tree. Now, if you take a piece out of the middle of that tree and put it under a microscope, now there has to be something that generates, you know, something at a deeper mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the stuff on the tree, we don't have to care about, you know, at that level. So, you know, the further down you go in this thinking, you realize that once you get down to the particle level, now I'm looking at a number of particles, and they have to have some rules. They have to be behaving in a certain way because I am measuring them. I'm observing them. So now we've made those particles lock into a particular state. That's exactly what happens in quantum mechanics. That's called decoherence, and that's, you know, that's why these effects occur. Everything else is probabilities until we force the program to generate reality, you know, in, mm-hmm. in our minds. That then you get things locked in. That's why entanglement occurs. You can take particles and move them light years apart from each other. Of course, they haven't been able to do that in experiments. They've done miles, 20 miles or something like that. But they've proven that these things they act as one particle. They don't act as two particles anymore. And the reason, I would say, is because they're following rules of the program in lockstep. You know, the program is saying, well, you know, there's like a little state machine, if you will. You know, the program is saying, okay, when this particle has the spin up, this particle over here has spin down. And every time it clocks through another calculation of reality, it sets those two particles to be equivalent. So for all intents and purposes, those particles are one and the same. It's like two pixels on the computer screen that you look at. Every clock cycle, those two pixels are being repainted. So the underlying construct that drives those pixels is something that's very consistent. You could move those pixels, you know, far apart from each other, and still every clock cycle they'll get repainted. It doesn't make any difference how far apart they are, because they're all driven by the same underlying mechanism. So that to me is a perfect explanation for every quantum mechanics anomaly. And I have on my site actually the kind of like pseudocode, little bits of pseudo software, if you will, that explains the observer effect and entanglement and non-locality and all these things that the scientists are kind of beating their head against the wall trying to figure out. It's perfectly logical if you think about it from a simulation standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, how funny would it be to find out that looking outward into space or down under a bigger and bigger microscope is just fruitless, because it will always unravel to be something else. Like we're living in an infinite field of waves, and the further you look out, the universe will just manifest more galaxies, more stars, more, you know, nebulas, and yep, it just will never end.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting you mentioned that. I had a blog recently too about these, you know, sort of another megatrend, humanity megatrend, of what our perception of all that there is. And it has changed maybe, I don't know, 9 or 10 times over the history of humanity. There was one point in time you could imagine that there were, you know, during a tribal era when people thought that all that existed was their tribes and the dominion that they lived in. And then along comes some other tribe from miles away and conquers them or whatever, and they realize, wow, our view of reality is much bigger than we previously thought. It's a whole level bigger, and it maybe expands now to a continent. And then at some point they realize that, wow, there are other continents on this planet. And at some point we realize there's other planets, and then we realize there's other solar systems, and so on and so on. And the interesting thing is that if you plot the dates at which we become aware that there's yet one more level of expansiveness to our worldview, if you will, they follow a perfect exponential pattern. And the last one was, again, in, say, like the 1990s, people like Max Tegmark talked about the multiverse theory. And postulated all kinds of ways that there could be parallel realities and parallel universes. Well, we're actually due for another one, and there is another one, and this other one is exactly what we're talking about tonight. It goes a little bit beyond the idea that we're just in a simulation. It explores the idea that if we're in a simulation, there is something that created it, so therefore all that we can know is in the simulation, but there's something else out there that created it. And what that reality is beyond the multiverse concept, because the multiverse concept still talks about physical realities. The next level of thinking here is non-physical realities, and this is where folks like Tom Campbell and Stephen Kaufman go into, you know, sort of a bigger description of what all that there is could be. And it's interesting that if you don't think about that, you're always in kind of a bubble, and your bubble is everything that you know, and so therefore you have to explain everything that you observe by what's within your bubble. But if you can somehow understand that there's something outside of that bubble and try to infer what that is, or maybe travel to it or whatever, and I think we do travel to that when we, you know, travel, you know, consciously, then you can realize that the mechanisms that created our bubble are different, and they mm-hmm. can explain some of the things that we see. It gives you a whole different perspective on the world that we're living in and the purpose that we have and things like that. So it's really very interesting to kind of go down that path. And it's a little bit beyond just pure simulation theory. It's, it's what else is out there,
Well, on the subject of the bubble, of being in the program, are there any clues to suggest what could possibly be there, what we could possibly see if someone pulled the plug on that program?
Yeah, I think when people die, they get a clue. Yeah. I don't know if you've followed much of the near-death experience research or, say, out-of-body experience research.
Yeah.
But these are cases, and it's not this isn't pseudoscience. I mean, these are real scientific studies that have been done, over many years, that there is a consistency of reports that people have. Their behavior changes after these things, which wouldn't make sense if it was hallucinatory. There are things that they experience that then can be corroborated later on, like, past life regressions, perhaps, or, telepathy or clairvoyance or something like that, remote viewing. I mean, the Army funded remote viewing for like 20 years, so it wasn't that it didn't work. I think they would have killed the program if it didn't work at all.
Right. So 20 years that they tell us about.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, these things go outside of the bubble that I referred to before, and so this is evidence. It's tricky evidence because it isn't necessarily as reproducible as a lot of scientists would like.
Mm-hmm.
But science isn't all about reproducibility. Something isn't science just because it's reproducible. There's lots of things that take geology, for example. Scientists try to infer why a particular geological formation occurred. That formation will never occur again exactly as it was. It may have been due to a unique event, a meteor or something like that. So reproducibility isn't required for science. Sum total of a lot of anecdotal information or survey information and things like that is real science. In psychological studies, that's real science. So,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you can go for it. I'm here all the time.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that these kinds of studies into what might otherwise be called paranormal, just because it doesn't fit in with the sort of materialist paradigm, these kind of studies are exploring, that next level of, quote, all that there is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really interesting.
It is. It's almost like that's the beauty of the design, is that the illusion is so strong. Like we talked about the discoveries that the world that we think is made up of stuff is mostly empty. The illusion is very strong, and I think that's the kicker to it, is that these types of out-of-body experience, I kind of think out-of-body experience, near-death experiences, dreams, psychedelic trips, I mean, even the fact that we call them trips, that's like a journey. I do think that those kind of things are all related and they're all clues, but the funny thing about it, the big joke, is that you can only have that experience for yourself. So you may get a clue, a major clue, about what exists outside the bubble, but you can't share it with anyone. It's like trying to explain the color green to a guy who's been blind his whole life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, this is, I thought about all of this in the sense of a sort of a, a line or a spectrum of what I would call consensus reality. So when you dream, you're by yourself. You're in your own mind, and you're experiencing something, some energy, some organizational structure of an experience, right? You're experiencing that, but you're doing it maybe by yourself, and so therefore you have the freedom to make of it what you will. if you can lucid dream, you can now mold it and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, there are studies of people who do mutual lucid dreaming. And now, when that happens, the people who are mutual lucid dreaming, there's a little bit of consensus that has to happen. They have to experience the same thing in a similar way. It doesn't have to necessarily be exact, but it's more toward that consensus reality side of the spectrum and not toward the, you know, personal fantasy type of the spectrum. In our day-to-day reality, we're very much toward the consensus reality end of the spectrum, because a car drives by and it's blue and you see it and I see it and we have to both say, hey, you know, we saw the same thing. But, you know, so we have this consensus, and that's what makes us think that this physical reality is so, quote, real, mm-hmm. and that the other stuff is not. It's just the consensus. But a consensus can be generated programmatically, too. If you're playing a virtual reality game on the computer with a bunch of people, you know, logged in from around the world, and everybody is shown the exact same thing, and a blue car drives by, and you say to some guy in Japan, hey, did you see that blue car? And he says, yeah, I saw it too, because the program has presented that to both of you. Now you feel like, wow, now I can really trust what I'm seeing because everybody else is seeing the same thing. Mm-hmm. But what if that guy is shown something different, shown something because of his level of expertise or his level of knowledge or his health points or whatever it is, and this happens in games, it's an easy thing to program, mm-hmm. now you have a little bit less consensus. That guy sees a UFO and I don't see it, or that guy experiences the monster in a different way than I do. It's all very possible, and it explains all of our less than perfect experiences of reality when compared to what other people experience. I mean, it happens a lot of times. People will say, well, I saw one thing and somebody else saw something else. Mm-hmm. That's okay. You know, that all fits within this paradigm.
You know, on the subject of lucid dreaming, it's almost like lucid dreaming is the placebo effect of that plane, because it almost ties into the power of thought. Because in a dream, 9 out of 10 times, you think everything is real. You think the danger is real. Everything that in your waking life you look at is, wow, that was completely strange and impossible. It seems very real. But then there's these people who have lucid dreams where they just completely realize it isn't and completely take control of it. And then, you know, in our waking life, we have this thing, the placebo effect, which is a very similar thing, just nerfed. It's very nerfed. But, you know, if there's plenty of cases of people who get better because they believe that they were given medicine when in reality they were given sugar pills or whatever. It's very strange. I mean, how far do you think you could follow that thread? How much do you think you could manifest your own reality, if at all?
Yeah, well, so I think this is very much related to the observer effect that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. When our consciousness interacts with matter, we create a reality. We, in the quantum mechanical terms, we collapse that wave function. We collapse that probability into an actual place and time, because of that the program has to do that. So the same thing happens with our future. Our future is all probabilities, isn't it? And if this physical reality is really just virtual, is just data that we're consciously processing, then we have more control for things that are further in the future than we do for things that are going to happen in 1 second. Because remember, the stuff that's going to happen in 1 second has to fit with everybody else's consensus. So you got a guy sitting next to you, and the two of you are watching a baseball game, and one of you tries to, you know, consciously make the player hit a home run, and the other one tries to consciously make the player strike out. You know, you can't both win that. So only one of those things is going to happen. Whereas, you know, further out in the future, there isn't so much, you're not so close to a consensus or a locked-in thing. You can influence things further out into the future. I mean, theoretically, that all makes kind of sense, mm-hmm. to me. You know, the program is, you know, if you believe in this kind of construct, and And I always say that I'm not, you know, 100% sure of it, but the evidence, my book is about evidence. It's not about, you know, I know this to be true or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, you know, you kind of think about this, you know, this power of positive thinking kind of aspect to it, then, you know, really there's no reason why you can't control your destiny to some extent, interact with people through means other than our normal communication, and all these kind of things that could be possible in a program. We don't necessarily know what the rules are of this simulation. We
right.
push the boundaries of them with studies like remote viewing and experiences like near-death experiences and so forth. And through those studies, we're starting to learn a little bit about what we can do and what we can't do. The placebo effect is showing us that our minds, which are not in our brains, our minds are probably somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
Really, really can influence and change our outcomes.
Well, it's funny because the idea of manifesting the reality, I would love for it to be true, but I have so much doubt. And in the conspiracy world, a lot of people believe that the elite's main objective through media manipulation and news manipulation is to create doubt and to create fear, because maybe the manifesting of reality is completely possible if you believe it, but yet we're conditioned to have so much doubt in ourselves that no one ever really can commit 100% to the premise because they've just gone through decades of being told that that's bullshit.
Yeah, I think that's really insightful. I think that's a good way of looking at it, that if we were fully free to... and this is one of Tom Campbell's arguments. If we were fully free to make of our reality what we want to make of it, we wouldn't learn as much as we do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in his philosophy, and this is something that kind of resonates with me, and to be honest, you know, from a standpoint of digital philosophy and digital physics, there's a lot of different views and a lot of different people out there who have been thinking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important that that we not be able to fully influence everything. If everybody was able to influence whatever that they wanted, they wouldn't learn as much. So, you know, some of the constraints that we have in terms of what we can, how we can communicate with others, what we can know about what's outside of the bubble, what we can know about a past life if we had them. Those kind of constraints are important so that we can learn faster and you know, add to the overall evolution of ourselves.
All right.
If you were to plot the amount of knowledge or wisdom that you attain, it probably is very steep early in your life, but as you get, you know, older, it flattens out, and you don't, you know, gain that much more. So the system, if you will, in order to optimize how much, you know, consciousness quality there is, it would have to, you know, encourage entities to live, you know, early in this cycle. So perhaps that's why there's death. Perhaps that's why we reincarnate. You know, this is all something that kind of fits in this theory.
Yeah, man, it's super fascinating. It kind of has a lot of parallels to the Zen philosophy that, you know, we just are the universe. The main difference just being, you know, are we the creator? Are we the programmer? Or is there some external programmer? Because I guess the big question is, how does the program decide to put rings on the inside of a tree trunk when you cut it open? You know, does it come from our own subconscious, what we would expect to see, we see? Or is the program using some other algorithm to create that stuff? You know, that's
right.
Kind of one of the fundamental questions.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think kind of using sort of a collection of ideas from shamanistic thinking, Zen philosophy, modern digital philosophy,
mm-hmm.
the program... if you want to call it that, or the system, has evolved, and it's evolved to learn to do what is best. So if the best thing is for it to be really efficient, and generate those, you know, the content of the rings of the trees, then that's what it's going to evolve to. I mean, if you think about sort of the theory of natural selection, Darwin's theory follows a similar type of approach. You know, the sheep that have the thicker wool in the high cold altitudes tend to pass on their genes more, whereas the others don't. So an artificial intelligence or a system of consciousness that is evolving is going to do different experiments, and the experiments that have positive or profitable results will get encouraged, and the ones that don't won't, and the thing will eventually evolve to be efficient. So this actually, you know, I read a book recently, a Zen book, and I read a passage in it, and I thought, oh my gosh, it sounds exactly like digital philosophy, and it's amazing that people thought the same way as, you know, some of us who are in this field are thinking now, and we've come at it from technology and physics and all these different, you know, fields. Mm-hmm. But it's matching, and that's really cool. It's almost telling us we're onto something.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be this meeting in the middle between psychedelic adventures, certain religions, and old Gnostic ideas, and modern science. It is a pretty interesting culmination, and it's funny because if you look at history, how opposed these different areas were, and as they all advance, they all seem to be, you know, coming to the middle. Maybe we're getting close to something.
Yeah, and I think we are, and I think that it's important to stay open-minded, and I think that there are very close-minded individuals on both sides of that fence, and some of them are pretty loud, and it's unfortunate.
Yes.
Because you know, all we're trying to do is seek the truth here, and do it without, you know, being told what we're allowed to think and what we're not allowed to think.
Right. Well, it's another curious thing, not to be too conspiratorial, but are those dogmatic voices in science, you know, are they popular because the people who don't want us to know the truth are in charge of the media, are in charge of what we see and who gets to be the loudest voice, and they purposely put those people up there for a reason, just to keep us in the dark a little bit longer? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I tend to think a little differently. I think it was Gandhi who once said, an expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing.
Yeah.
And that's not to disparage, you know, anyone who has gotten their PhD in a particular field or some advanced degree or really focuses on being an expert in a very narrow thing, but you can't be an expert in everything. So when you are an expert in a very narrow field, which tend to be scientists, people who write papers, people who you know, do the experiments and get known for these things. When you do have that very narrow but very deep set of knowledge, if somebody comes along and pulls it out from under you, your whole reason for being, your whole, you know, reason for getting funding, you know, that helps pay your mortgage and you know, maintains your stature at your university or whatever, that all goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of fear and defense mechanism that happens when people start challenging some of these very old ideas.
Oh, I totally agree with you that is the reality, but I guess I just have more of a question of if it's just unfortunately the way it is, or if it's a result of careful planning to orchestrate that system. But another thing I wanted to ask you about was the idea of, you know, as we look out into the universe, it manifesting itself as we look further and further and develop the ability to do so. How do you think that could apply to extraterrestrials? Do you think maybe being more open to the idea in modern times, having more of an expectation of the possibility of finding something, that it might actually bring it to fruition?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You know, they may be other organized conscious entities in the greater field of consciousness, as we are, just different, and the rules of our interaction are different than what the rules of our interaction with ourselves are. You know, that's sort of how the way I would look at it. You know, if we want to make more contact, we probably the more that we get in touch with this, you know, idea of how there's one global consciousness, and maybe make requests for those interactions might bring us closer.
Yeah, it's a curious thing. Maybe we're already deeply in those communications and we just don't know it.
We might be. It might be some of what happens in the dream state too.
Yeah, totally agree. Hey, it's been great talking to you, man. Before we go, I wanted to ask you one other thing. It seems like I see new crazy scientific discoveries like every other day online, whether I understand it or not. But what are some of the more recent things to come out of the internet that you've seen that most interest you?
Well, one of them that I just saw last night was fascinating, was a study with some experimental evidence that shows that time may come out of this whole entanglement idea. So time itself exists within the sort of the bubble of space where things are entangled, and outside of it, time doesn't exist at all. I'm still trying to wrap my head around this, but this one, I mean, it feels to me intuitively like it may be another piece of the puzzle. It might be something that you know, can give us some more you know, enlightenment about the way the greater reality works.
Yeah,
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's almost like an evolution of the same principle that, you know, the reality we look at, the stuff we look at feels so solid, looks so solid, but it's mainly empty. You know, time feels like such a fundamental necessity, yet, you know, if there was a way to explore it deeper, we might find that, you know, there's more timelessness than timeness.
Exactly. Yeah, and there was also an article about some people from Arizona State. Paul Davies was one of the ones, a very well-known scientist, that the transition from inorganic to organic life was based on information and not chemistry. Well, that all fits in perfectly with the programmed reality idea as well. So a lot of you know, cool things that people are starting to think about if they stay open-minded.
Yeah, right on, man. I mean, I think I'm not a smart man, but I'm an open-minded man. So sometimes that's better.
Well, you asked some great questions, so I'd put you on the smart side.
Well, I appreciate your kindness. But, well, man, it has been a blast talking to you, even though I feel more insignificant than ever. I'm somehow still in a good mood.
I think that's okay. I do, too, and I'm all right with that.
For sure. Do you want to tell the people a little bit about your book and your website before we go?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the book is called The Universe Solved. It's available on Amazon, both in a hardback form and a Kindle version. The website is theuniversesolved.com, and that's you know, probably be doing an overhaul of that over the next year or so. Right now, it's got a lot of interactivity on it. There's a forum. There's my blog, polls, all kinds of things where people can interact and explore things. And just want to kind of bring it up to date a little bit. So. There's even an artificial intelligence on there named Morpheus that you can, a chat bot that you can chat with. So, I'm always interested in talking to people, too, about these kinds of things. So if anybody has ideas, wants to explore anything, they can follow me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, send me emails, whatever. It all works.
Right on. Very cool. Jim, thanks again, and be sure to give me a call when you get this whole reality thing sorted out, all right?
Okay, thanks, Greg. Great talking to you. Thanks for the interview.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, people, that was Jim Elvidge. What a great guest. Hey, thanks for listening, people. I really appreciate it. I'm honored. I'm humbled. I can't believe it. The show grows more every day, and I am probably more surprised than anybody. With that said, please participate in the THC Money Bomb if you have any interest in that. The donation link is on the page, and you can go to www.thehighersidechats.com/donate to be involved. If you like t-shirts, I'm selling them, conspiracies.net. And that's about all I got, so I'll see you next week. Again, thanks so much. Please share the show and review it where you can. You're the goddamn best. We're trapped inside the matrix, forced to play our hand. We're filled with so much hatred, the kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't stand a chance. Sometimes it's hard to grow while living in fear of the unknown. How can he ever give love when no love is in his heart? A child can barely sleep at night, too worried about tomorrow, and what if the kids don't stand a chance.